All right, it's a pleasure to be with you this morning. I'm especially pleased to see such a large crowd in the audience at such a late hour. And so I'd like to talk to you a little bit about some of our work looking at carbon sequestration and especially the carbon dioxide fluxes through this switchgrass bioenergy system that we've been working with, and look at some of the components of the fluxes that lead to the different sequestration rates that we see. Is the mouse supposed to?
Yeah.
Oh, there we go. That one. Okay, just a little bit of a description of our research site and the work that we did. It was located here in southwestern Pennsylvania, about an hour to the east of where we're standing right now, about an 8-hectare field that was planted to switchgrass in June of 2004. In this particular site, among the different scenarios that we're looking at with switchgrass, looking at different things like row spacing and harvest timing, this was managed to provide for a spring harvest. So actually what we would do is we'd let the crop grow all summer long, and then it would stand in the field throughout the winter and wouldn't be harvested until the next spring, right before the next year's crop would start to grow. And there are some kind of quality benefits for bioenergy crops if you do that that really won't go into today. And so we did that. So again, I say it was planted in June of 2004. There really wasn't enough biomass to harvest in 2005. And so then the first harvest was in April of 06, and then again in 07 and 08. So we have 4 years we monitored these sites. Because of the letting the switchgrass stand over winter, you end up getting a lot of lodging and a lot of residue that's left behind. And so we also did samples of the residual biomass to see what was left behind in the field. Okay, to measure and look at our carbon dioxide fluxes, we used eddy covariance technology. And basically what we do, these systems, we have a 3D sonic anemometer, and you can't really see it very well here, but a Licor 7500 CO2 and water vapor analyzer. And what these systems do is they collect data on vertical wind velocity and CO2 and water vapor concentrations 10 times a second. And then it correlates changes in vertical wind velocity with CO2 concentration and gives you indication of the flux. And we do these, they're averaged over 20-minute periods. And so every 20 minutes we get a measure of the net CO2 flux, and then this continues 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, so we can completely monitor the fluxes throughout the year. This system provides us with the net ecosystem exchange, which is the balance between photosynthesis or gross primary productivity and ecosystem respiration. And so you get that net difference, and then mathematically you can partition your fluxes into GPP and RE. So you can and look at those two components separately and see how they're changing over the course of the year. And so we started these measurements in October of 2004 and went for 4 years. And so I'll be showing by year, but it'll be kind of a fiscal year thing from October 1 to September 30th. Just a little bit of the weather during these 4 years. Precipitation was dry, relatively dry the first year, a little bit wetter the second, and then wetter the last 2 years. I won't go into the data, but there's really no indication for the last 3 years that water deficits were having any effect on the switchgrass photosynthesis. Perhaps a little bit of effect in this year that it was not really related. Well, I'll get into why that might be in a minute. Air temperature, relatively consistent between about 9.7 and 10 degrees, and range from about minus 20 to kind of the mid 30s. And if you think back to your warm season grass physiology, you'll remember that this kind of temperature is kind of right about where you get maximum photosynthetic uptake on a warm season grass, kind of the mid 30s. And that was the highest temperatures we ever saw each year. So most of the time, these systems' temperature would be sub optimum for photosynthetic uptake. And then if you look at the soil temperature, quite interesting, the first year mean soil temperature was quite a bit higher than other years, and there was about a degree and a half almost difference between the air and the soil temperature, and this was measured at 5 centimeter depth. But as that switchgrass crop matured and more cover, believe it reduced the radiation reaching the soil surface, and each year that mean soil temperature went down and the difference between air and soil temperature became less. And I think that'll have important ramifications for some of the data that we see in a second. Okay, so if you look just at the harvested biomass, and so we're looking at during the establishment of switchgrass, which can be a fairly slow process sometime. So again, as I said, in 2005 there was no harvest, and you can see it's quite a dramatic increase in biomass each year. And you can see the very large amount of residual biomass left behind. In fact, that first harvest there was more residual left behind than there was that was actually picked up by the harvester. And that residual biomass averaged about 40 to 45% of the total biomass that was available at the time of the harvest. So just again, keep in mind again that we're looking at significant increases in biomass as we go through time. Okay, let's look at the carbon flux data here. And to kind of set this up, again, we're doing a fiscal year, so we're starting October 1 and going through the end of September. Net ecosystem exchange in grams of carbon dioxide per square meter per day. And with this system, positive means flux to the atmosphere. Negative is flux into the system. So negative, it's kind of counterintuitive for agronomists that negative is uptake and positive is loss. And so you see, as you would expect, from October through the winter, you get a small loss of CO2. The first year is quite different than the next three. We see it start to take up carbon quite a bit earlier in the spring the first year than we see in the last 3 years. That's because we had quite a cool season grass weed problem the first year, mostly foxtail. And you can see that cool season signature in the data as those grasses started growing much earlier. And so we see a lot earlier uptake that year. But in the second, third, and fourth years, the switchgrass had managed to outcompete the cool season grasses that pretty much disappeared. And so it's a pretty much a pure switchgrass stand after that. And so we see carbon uptake starting about mid-May, peaks during the months of June and July, and then decreases. And by about the beginning of September, there's no more net uptake. And I think this is interesting and important. There's only about a 100-day period through the growing season where these switchgrass fields are a net sink for CO2. So we're talking about 100 days of being a net sink and 260-some-odd days of being a net source of CO2. And that's important when you start looking at these carbon balances. Now, if you partition that between photosynthesis and respiration, the filled symbols are the respiration data, and again, loss, very low levels of loss throughout the winter, and then as summer approaches, we see an increase during summer and then a decrease in respiration, tied very closely to soil temperature is the main driver of that. And again, with the photosynthetic uptake, we see nothing going on a little bit beginning of October, but really nothing during the winter. And then again, that cool season, weedy grasses the first year. But after that, uptake beginning about early May and peaking again June and July, and then a gradual decrease. And so we see net photosynthetic uptake, but gross photosynthetic uptake extends for about a 150-day period. But, you know, only 100 of that is there enough photosynthesis to compensate for the amount of respiration going on. Right, so if you sum all those annual totals together and look across years, first of all, photosynthesis, gross primary productivity, and the interesting thing is that there's really no difference or very little difference from year to year. And if you remember, we were seeing a huge increase in yield as we went from these years where we measured from about 200 grams per meter squared to 800. And yet, photosynthetic uptake is exactly the same across those years. And these photosynthesis rates are quite low compared to other work we've done on cool season pastures in Pennsylvania and to a lot of what you see in the literature. Now, the real difference among years is in the respiratory loss. Very high the first year and then decreasing over time. And if you remember back when I was talking about the soil temperatures and that big difference in soil temperature and the difference between soil and air temperature the first year and how that decreased, I think this is being driven a lot by those decreases in soil temperature. And what would be really nice is if we could partition respiration between the plants and the soil. Unfortunately, we can't do that with these systems, but I think that would tell an interesting story, perhaps. And so net ecosystem exchange is the difference, is the sum of these two, and we see that all 4 years were over the course of the year, even though we only have that 100-day period where it's a net sink, it's a, as far as net ecosystem exchange is concerned, it's a sink for all 4 years. But if you really want to calculate the change in soil carbon or ecosystem carbon, you have to also include what's being removed by the harvest. And so that's what we've done in this column is calculated, taken those biomass yields and turned them into CO2 equivalents. And so this is how much would be removed each year. And then if you add this to your NEE, you get net biome productivity, which would be the net change in ecosystem carbon over the course of the year. And you can see the first 3 years, these systems were a sink for CO2, but this last year, it actually became a source. And that was a function, a lot of this increased harvest removal, but also a slightly, this very slight increase in respiration. So NEE was a little bit lower. But it was mostly due to this increased harvest that we turned into a source rather than a sink. Very quickly with this system, we were also able to look at water vapor fluxes. And so we see that evapotranspiration follows a very similar pattern as photosynthesis, and they're very highly correlated with each other. Maximum respiration rates evapotranspiration rates of about 3 to 3.5 millimeters per day, quite a bit lower than what you would see for warm season grasses someplace like the Kansas Prairie in the Midwest. And then finally, if you look at water use efficiency, which would be the photosynthetic uptake divided by evapotranspiration, see how it increases during May, kind of peaks in June and July at about 12 to 14 milligrams of CO2 per gram of water, and then a slow decrease over the August and September. So just looking at the growing season data. And these water use efficiency results are fairly similar to what you would see elsewhere. So just to summarize our results, averaged over 4 years, these switchgrass stands were a net sink of 142 grams of CO2 per meter squared per year. So during this establishment phase, they were acting as a sink. It's interesting that it was annual differences in net ecosystem exchange were more closely tied to changes in respiration rather than photosynthesis. And we've seen this as well in cool season pastures in Pennsylvania. There's a lot of work in the literature that shows this in all kinds of ecosystems, from pastures to forests, that it appears to be differences in respiration rather than photosynthesis that are driving changes in that ecosystem exchange. Then finally, my sense is that the high residual biomass that's being left behind by this spring harvest system is responsible for a lot of the net CO2 accumulation that we're seeing, that if we were, you know, picking up and removing all of that biomass, perhaps with the fall harvest, that we wouldn't be seeing as much sequestration as we are seeing. Okay, and that is the end. Any questions? Yeah.
Did you attempt to measure soil respiration, or were you measuring that off the flux tower?
Yeah, all the respiration was measured off the flux tower. Yeah, we used our night values, and then would do a regression between soil temperature and nighttime values, and then use that temperature respiration relationship to calculate daytime respiration. So the daytime was tied to the temperature during the day.
I'd like to hear your opinion regarding the larger issue. Switchgrass has been touted as a way of absorbing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, serving to sequester or to utilize as a fuel source or whatever. Give us your view, having had this experience, on the potential for switchgrass to be a partial solution to our dilemma of global warming and the role of agriculture in this complex.
Okay. Well, and there are two very, you know, separate related issues in that, and one is the use of switchgrass as a fuel source. And that's the work my co-author, Paul Adler, has really been doing a lot of work in looking at life cycle assessments and trying to get at this whole issue. And I think it appears that if you look at switchgrass as a cellulosic source, that I think there is some promise there. I think in our situation, in our conditions, I think it would be a minor player in terms of carbon sequestration.
Because of the short growing season.
And I think it's a lot because of the short growing season. As you look at the literature and results from switchgrass in the Great Plains, in North Dakota, South Dakota, some of these places, you're seeing a lot more sequestration in that part of the country than we saw here. And as I'm looking at literature from the Southeast, I think there's not a lot of it yet, but it seems to suggest perhaps kind of lower sequestration rates in the Southeast as well. And I think it's a combination of low temperatures and low radiation. We just don't have the sunlight that they have in Nebraska. Yes?
Did you consider about the below-ground biomass carbon and also the root biomass, and also how about directly thinking about the soil carbon? What will happen in your system of carbon sequestration directly thinking about the soil carbon?
Okay. Well, now, of course, we did a little bit of looking at it below ground at the roots. I think as far as this, our system goes, you know, it integrates everything that's happening. And so actually from year to year, part of the sequestration that we're seeing may not necessarily be soil organic matter, but it may be a buildup in the root system or a decrease in the root system. And so a lot of these things we can't look at, you know, specifically and independently. We're just kind of integrating everything together. So, you know, so it's all the carbon in the system and the change in that we're looking at. And and not necessarily soil carbon.
We can get one piece. It is so much interesting. The only 3 months photosynthesis rate is. I'd like to know is which feta contributes most. For example, light intensity or matcha or plant growth pattern is. Which one is the most contributes to be at 3 months?
That's a good question, and I don't think I can really give you a definitive answer on that. I haven't tried to, separate out those different influences. So, that would be interesting to do and try and come to some conclusion in which is the dominant controller, but I haven't really tried to do that.
Well, I was informed that our last speaker canceled the presentation, so Dr. Skinner's presentation was our last presentation. And I was preparing to make some final considerations, but I think that everyone is ready to go home. So all I want to say is thank you very much. Thank you to all the presenters. Your job was fantastic. That's why we have such a good number of people here. And thank you for coming.
Yeah.